ADKT-0581 and ADKT-0613. And it's a time set for public hearing and comment on those matters. So we're ready to proceed? Are we ready to proceed?
I'm ready.
Yeah.
Can you hear us in Las Vegas?
Wave if you can.
Just wave. Proof of life.
Yeah, okay.
We can hear.
It's not me.
Calling the matter. Anyone want to introduce the matter?
I'll introduce it.
All right. Justice Herndon, please.
So we had asked to put these both on together, obviously, since they're somewhat interrelated in terms of the work of the Virtual Advocacy Commission as well as the need to make the amendment to Supreme Court Rule Part 9BA governing the appearances by telephonic transmission equipment. Just in a nutshell, the commission was put together last year at the behest of Justice Hardesty. Actually, I think it was Justice Hardesty when he was the chief the year before last that first put the idea in place to get the commission going. And the commission began its work last year. We tried as best as possible through the help of our wonderful staff, Jamie and Amita, to kind of cull together as many people as we could from around the state from as kind of a diverse a background as we could. So we had folks from Northern Nevada. We had folks from Southern Nevada. We had folks from rural Nevada. We had folks from Legal Aid as well as the State Indigent Services Division. We had justices, we had judges, we had justices of the peace, and we had practitioners, criminal and civil and family. And from the criminal and civil side, I would say we had practitioners both on the plaintiff side as well as the defense side. One thing that I was delighted about was at the end of the day, and I'll look to see, and Jamie can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think once we actually voted on our recommendations to come forward, it was unanimous, if I recall correctly, yes. And that doesn't go to say that everything we discussed was always unanimous within our subcommittees, but certainly we were able to get everybody to kind of understand the need to come up with some consistent ideas to be utilized around the state to the benefit of the public and practitioners who are going to be appearing in our courts. So that they would have the understanding and knowledge about what to expect as a, you know, many people practice in various jurisdictions around the state. So we thought that was important. Obviously, understanding that the issues are different within the civil courts, within the criminal courts, within the family courts, and then within the limited jurisdiction courts, those were our four subcommittees that were put together to kind of come up with the recommendations as to what was going to be presumptively virtual and what was going to be presumptively in person. And I emphasize presumptively because the rules don't stand for a mandatory proposition that something always has to be one or the other. They just start with the default as to whether it's going to presumptively be in person, at which point you could always request of the court granting leave to appear virtually. And if it's presumptively virtual, you don't need leave of the court. You can always just show up and have your matter be heard in person, obviously. And then as we deciphered through those things, there were things that I think amongst all of the subcommittees were important, and that is generally matters that involve some type of contested hearing that involves witnesses and evidence is where the default went to presumptively in person, and everything else to the benefit of practitioners and the public. We were trying to make as many concessions as we could to make those things presumptively virtual. There was a lot of discussion as well about the aspect of how the judges independently could apply the rules within their courts. The idea is, even though I said nothing is mandatory, the idea is obviously to create the consistency and to have the understanding that judges would be strongly encouraged to apply the rules, but understand that there's always going to be exigencies, and in different practice areas and in different jurisdictions within the state, there may be individual issues that a judge may determine are done better virtually or better in person, and that they have the discretion apply their particular area's needs to address how they're going to hold those hearings. What we did not want to do, however, is have any type of, and I know this was mentioned in some of the public comments, any type of rules be put in place where judges could then be given the discretion as to whether they had to follow the rules or not, quite honestly. So the idea is to adopt these and have them be utilized statewide, and then to amend the Supreme Court rule to be in conformance with what the proposal is here. And that was really a timing element. The proposal is that if you're presumptively in person and you want to move to a virtual appearance, you need to let court and counsel know at least 48 hours prior to the hearing or as soon as practical. That's where the need to change the Supreme Court rule came in, because if I recall correctly, the Supreme Court rule originally had, I think, a 5-day notice requirement on making telephonic appearances as opposed to in-person appearances. And obviously that rule was created way before we had the COVID issues and began embracing technology in the courtroom. So I've said enough. I don't know if Justices Lee or Justices Perigary want to add anything, and I probably should have thanked them in the beginning because they jumped in to help me out after the retirement of Justice Hardesty.
Just a quick addition. There are certain statutes which already have baked into them virtual versus in-person. We exempted out those and said that, you know, if the statute applies and mandates that you appear in person, those are proposed. ADKT does not supersede those statutes. So just wanted to, like in family law, I think there's a couple of statutes where they either want you there personally or not, so.
Yeah, and I think Justice Hernan summed it up pretty well. I kind of came in late, as did Justice Lee, but we had a number of hearings and a lot of input on a lot of the comments that were presented to us for this public hearing. We debated those in depth. And so nothing that we've seen by way of comment is new. We've gone through a lot of this, and we've come up with what I think is a good set of rules. So thank you, Justice Hernan, for chairing this commission.
One thing I wanted to add, Chief, if I could, I forgot. Early on, and I don't recall exactly when it was last year, but as part of the commission, we caused surveys to be sent out to every attorney in the state and every judge in the state, no matter their level, and had a pretty incredible response rate on that was utilized and reviewed by everybody on the commission as the subcommittees were doing their work as well.
All right, thank you. Anybody would like to speak to this? These ADKTs, we can start in we'll start in Las Vegas.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Thank you for the opportunity to provide feedback on ADKT 0581. I'm Deborah Bookout, the directing attorney for the Guardianship Advocacy Project at Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada. As you can see from our written comments, we are primarily seeking for some clarification on Exhibit C of the final report and recommendations of the Commission to Study Best Practices for Virtual Advocacy. So I want to point you to Exhibit C, which is our primary concern. Obviously, we are in family court. It delineates presumptive appearance by case type for family cases, and it starts with a section titled All Case Types. This section delineates four hearing types that are presumptively in person. And the two that are of concern to us in guardianship are evidentiary hearings and orders to show cause hearings. So that's where you start. You look at all case types, and it has presumptively in person, evidentiary hearings, and orders to show cause hearings. However, when you look at page 3 of Exhibit C, where the adult guardianship cases case type is delineated, it has written under there, all adult guardianship cases are presumptively virtual. So if adult guardianship cases are subject to the all case type section, then there needs to be clarification about this, right? If the intent was that all other adult guardianship cases should be held presumptively virtual, then there just needs to be a clarification about that. So then the other question or concern and need for clarification is the second hearing type, orders to show cause hearings. You'll note also on page 3 that for minor guardianship case type, citation hearings are presumptively virtual. And I'm going to speak to this from as it pertains to adults. My colleague will be speaking to this issue with, as it pertains to minors. But in all guardianship matters, citation hearings are orders to show cause hearings. So any petition for guardianship is a citation and appear to show cause. A petition to obtain guardianship, a petition to terminate guardianship, and a petition to remove a guardian is a citation and a show cause hearing. So if orders to show cause includes citation hearings, and of course the question is, did it, because it delineated them under minor guardianship cases, then all we need is clarification that adult guardianship cases and minor guardianship cases are subject to that first section under Exhibit C, all case types. And this is important because, as Justice Herndon noted, these citation hearings, these order show cause hearings, are actually hearings where the court can make assessments, view evidence, assess and interact with parties. And in guardianship, it may be the only hearing in which all of the parties appear before the court. And in adult guardianship cases, it is the hearing in which the court determines whether potentially this person, this proposed protected person, lose civil rights, certain civil rights for the remainder of their life. So not insignificant hearings, these citation hearings. They are not perfunctory. They're not ministerial. They're substantive and they're significant. So with that, if there are no questions, I'll turn it over to my colleagues.
I have a couple of questions. Thank you so much for your time today and coming to speak on this. When we're talking about adult guardianship cases being presumptively virtual, are you saying that within that kind of umbrella of type of hearing type, you can have evidentiary hearings, contested prove-ups, those type of things? So you're saying that would conflict, pages 3 and 1 conflicts in that regard?
Yes. Yes. So, you know, evidentiary hearings are generally contested in guardianship, right? Mm-hmm. But for some reason, under the case type of guardianship, it's not allowing for contested matters to be heard in person at all. But I don't think that was the intent. And so, you know, therein is the need for clarification. If it was the intent, then I would suggest we revisit that. Citation hearings are contested often and are set over for evidentiary hearings, which, of course, are contested.
I see. And then for citation hearings, which are under the adult guardianship is virtual, you're saying those are tantamount to orders to show cause, which have to be in person. Do you have a recommendation one way or the other? It sounds like you would prefer to have those be in person.
Yes. Citation hearings in guardianship are orders to show cause. And under all case types, our position would be that they should be considered order to show cause hearings such that they would be presumptively in person.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Marina Dahlia Hunt. I'm the team lead for the Minor Guardianship Advocacy Program at Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada. My colleague, Ms. Bookout, spoke about adult guardianship. I'm here to speak exclusively about minor guardianship. So in echoing Ms. Bookout's statements, first, in minor guardianship, as Justice Leah alluded to, NRS 159A.0535 requires the physical attendance of children at citation hearings for the initial petition for appointment of guardian over a child. If the intention is not to conflict with any existing statutes, then I don't think any further clarification needs to be made on the attendance of children and parties at citation hearings. I just want to take a moment to explain that in minor guardianship cases, these cases are substantively identical in a lot of ways to those that are in the dependency realm. A lot of these children have experienced physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, neglect, domestic violence. But the major difference among many is that most of the parties that are served by the Margaret guardianship system are pro per. There's no appointed counsel for parents. There is sometimes through our office appointment of counsel for minors, and there's rarely counsel for the guardians. So that leaves the entire realm of protecting these children and making decisions in their best interest to one entity, which is the court. There's also no regular review hearings or check-ins, no social workers, as there would be in dependency. So as Ms. Bookout mentioned, citation hearings are often the only hearing in minor guardianship for the court to assess the matter, to determine whether guardianship should be granted, to connect the guardian with potential services, to answer questions from any of the parties. And it's also an opportunity for the court to assess potential safety issues relating to the appointment of guardian. A child is obviously reliant on an adult to attend a hearing, so requiring the caregiver to bring them to the court as the law requires would accomplish the goal of making sure, at least for some circumstances, that the child is safe. So as Ms. Bookout mentioned, our request would just be that Exhibit C be clarified to state that citation to appear and show cause under guardianship are considered order to show cause hearings and be held presumptively in person. The citations are the hearings where, as Justice Herndon mentioned, witnesses and evidence are most likely to be presented. Very few of these cases proceed to evidentiary hearing, and they can sometimes be contested as well. So that's what I would that's my request. If there are any questions.
Anyone have any questions?
No, but one thing I'll say, we were, and I'll admit to my own ignorance with a lot of the family court proceedings and the mechanics of those. So we relied pretty heavily on the practitioners. But my understanding in some of the representations were being made is that not all adult guardianship hearings or not all citation hearings and minor guardianships necessarily involve a contested hearing, an evidentiary hearing, the presentation of witnesses, or an order to show cause, such that the idea was to create the 30,000-foot view of those as presumptively virtual. And then under all case types, if it is going to be an evidentiary hearing or if it is an order to show cause, then that was presumptively in person. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
I would just say we generally, as I said, most of these petitioners and parties are pro per, so we often don't know if the matter will be contested until the day of the hearing, until the parties show up online or in person.
And
so it's hard to tell ahead of time.
Yeah, that issue came up, and I don't know if it was in regard to discussing the guardianship hearings or not, but the issue came up about sometimes you don't know until you get there. And that's why mm-hmm. the courts have to have discretion, I think, that if you're going to allow things to be presumptively virtual, it may be that it needs to be converted into an in-person hearing, and you got to be patient and maybe mm-hmm. set another date. But we are trying to be cognizant of the issues that I think you alluded to somewhat about, for instance, adults having to take kids out of school and bring them to court mm-hmm. when maybe that's not necessarily needed based upon what's going to happen at that hearing, at least in the first instance.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I think we can't know until the citation, and the courts could, of course, exercise discretion in continuing a citation to require the attendance of the children in person. The children are required to attend the citations to appear and show cause under the statute unless there's a doctor's note. So that hurdle already exists, and they do already need to miss school for this one hearing. But we would never request that perfunctory hearings, status checks, accountings would need to be presumptively in person, just these initial citation hearings.
Okay.
And evidentiary hearings.
Thank you, Chief. Thank you very much. I appreciate you coming.
And could you please state your name for the record before you go?
Oh, yes. Marina Dahlia Hunt, MarinaDahlia-HUNT.
Thank you so much. Right. Any further comment in Las Vegas? All right, then we'll turn to Carson City. Comment in Carson City? Judge Jones?
Good afternoon. Chief Judge Lynn Jones from the Second Judicial District Court, and I want to so thank the committee and what was obviously the fruits of a lot of hard work and discussion and then became the fruits of a very interesting judges meeting in our district as everybody weighed in. I'm not sure if they took the survey or not. I'm going to go back and ask. But what overarching in this that I kept thinking about and we were talking about is just that we do have different districts with different needs and different types of cases, and we handle them differently. And I think the perception was that good cause should not be, a court should not have to show good cause, and that it should be judicial officer driven and not necessarily party driven. What I did was collect comments from all of my colleagues, which you could see in what we submitted. Some people are very passionate about different aspects. One of my colleagues brought up the issue of if it is a stipulated probation case and the person is out of town, let's say in Chicago, I've had those. But what if the judge decides not to give probation? You know, should that be a presumptively virtual matter, and does that take away from the judge's ability to sentence? I think on the other piece of it is to recognize that even with us, all of us are different. For instance, I enjoy doing settlement conferences by Zoom because if it's a complicated trust case, I have 9 people all over the country in huge law firms. And it's easier for me to run through breakout rooms and also people to participate that wouldn't be able to, a beneficiary that might be unrepresented. So I'm very comfortable with that. Many of my colleagues are not, and they would prefer to have them in person, which I think that that's probably where, as far as settlement conferences, that came from. The 48-hour notice was of great concern, particularly to in the family court, because yes, you can be, you don't know sometimes until these self-represented litigants are there, right there, saying they want to do this or they want to do that. The notice isn't always properly given if that person requests, rather than it coming from the court. And then it's how do you document that notice? How do you, one person says they didn't get it, the other one did, but more importantly, how do you mobilize your staff and the judge to be prepared for the hearing in a different manner? And also because the exhibits become are challenging. So that was really, and that exigent circumstance and good cause was of great concern to the presiding judge, Judge Liu, and also her family court colleagues. So I think in our, certainly the spirit that, and the reason why we made our comments so detailed, is that it isn't that we don't think that this is a great idea. It's just that I think we believe in practicality that there may need to be some refinement. And what would be the voice to be able to make those refinements? And that's where the judicial discretion comes in. In our court, my colleagues, I have wonderful colleagues who utilize virtual and in-person very well, and that kind of suits their needs. We all have a practice of how to notice people and accommodate that. The last point that I'll make is the perception that the judge would be the only person ordered to be into the courtroom. Now, I will tell you this, my Zoom is clear across the room, and it's hard because you look at the wrong cameras, but if I bring my laptop into, it's an interesting experience to be the only person in the room, in your courtroom on your Zoom. And there was some of my colleagues that were concerned that it should be a courthouse location. Like if I'm doing my specialty court docket, YLC. These people live and breathe their phones, their Zoom. That's why I'm not bringing them back in person for a while. They're 18 to 27-year-olds, and the best way I can talk to them is on their phone, on Zoom. And so I usually do it from my chambers. I'm just not right on the other side of the wall. And I think that part could be more defined. We provide Zoom rooms. We have like a Zoom pod downstairs, Zoom rooms. So sometimes my specialty court clients or participants, if they do have trouble with their phone, they can come to the court. And they already have to come to the court to check in. We're trying to be a bit circumspect about the big demands that we make on them to work and for them to miss a day to come to court in person. Is even for the first one, we don't do for the first appearance, and I think that's what your presumption was. We're educating employers, they're getting to do it on breaks. It's a different specialty court than it maybe was 5 years ago, but it's working. But each judge, even there, is different. I have one colleague that would rather do some in person. So I think that the discussion and what I'm trying to convey to you, and I tried to convey in the letter, is that my colleagues just have strong opinions about certain parts of this. And that while we appreciate the process, that perhaps we could acknowledge that there could be some refinement.
We have questions for Judge Jones. I have a couple questions. So Judge Jones, I see on page 2, the general jurisdiction comments about judicial officers being present in the courtroom.
Right.
And you go on to say that probably should be clarified as courthouse. I appreciate
exactly.
those comments, what you're saying.
Yes.
And I think in the spirit of what the committee is trying to do, and I think it is the takeaways, at least my takeaways, just one person, from COVID is that for hundreds of years, all of these things were set up for the convenience of judges and not for the convenience or with thought to litigants in making justice affordable, making access possible to as many people in these important matters. And so I think I always view these through the lens of what's best for the litigants, guided by judicial discretion as case appropriate and not necessarily just judicial preference. I like to do these here, right? You know, because we get different comments and different calls about that. Like, this judge won't let anybody appear remotely.
Right.
This judge won't come in. This judge won't, you know, do that. And so it's kind of like, again, we start talking about judges, and I think the committee worked really hard to strike that balance in terms of what are we trying to accomplish? Why do we have video stuff at all? Well, so that more people can access this courtroom without losing jobs, without, you know, real disruption. So those are just...
And I don't think that it's a one-size-fits-all. I mean, I think that's where the committee did a brilliant work in trying to make it a little bit more one-size-fits-all. I mean, I had somebody begging me for a virtual hearing, and it was just more appropriate for her to be there in person. She was able to be there in person. Mm-hmm. It was just that she didn't want to be. And it ended up, she came in and she was heard. And I think there's two sides to that coin. There's one that more people can be heard in the courtroom. There's also the other flip side, more people can be heard on a platform, potentially. So you had another question?
No, I think that's it.
But I want to just make sure that I'm saying, and I had to put this together very quickly because of the time frames and because of the Thanksgiving holiday, but it just was for the Second Judicial District Court and my colleagues to be heard about their individual, in some of our family courts, somebody, if they can't have that hearing that day, they're 4 or 5 months out, which is challenging. And so I think that that's where the recommendation from a couple of judges came, that we should try to fashion local rules in accordance with the spirit and what is requested. We don't have the issue in our district about people not coming in. We don't have it. We have some people that do more guardianship and dependency, and they tend to do more by Zoom. I frankly don't know their family division. I don't know if they're in the courthouse or not. We have some big challenges with our building, and even, you know, frankly, there are certain spots that are better if you are doing something virtually. And for me, I view that as accommodating access, particularly for the specialty court people. It's worked remarkable. And so, any other questions?
Chief?
Yes.
Judge Jones, just to follow up on this discussion, in the proposed, the preamble, where where it mentions about judicial officers should be present in the courtroom, the reasoning provided is because attorneys, their clients, and the public should have the ability to attend court proceedings in person if they so desire. So I guess my question is that if we just say on the court premises, which with presumably some judges conducting the hearings from in their chambers, which I understand it, but how would we accommodate that interest in public access and party access to in-person if they want to?
And I think this may be a bit different than our colleagues in the Eighth. For most, we cannot, it's a pretty rare occasion that we can do blended hearings where you might have someone on Zoom and someone in person. Oh. And there are also, so except for potentially witnesses occasionally when it's granted, we're usually completely in person or completely in Zoom for a proceeding. And we navigate back and forth.
So if you have a hearing, sorry, I just want to follow up and understand. If you have, let's assume civil for now. If there's a civil motion hearing that maybe is presumptively virtual, if an attorney wants to come in and argue their motion in person, they can't come in person and have someone else on the Zoom.
No, and many people feel that there should, some of my colleagues feel that there could be an unfairness if one side was in person and one side was on Zoom.
Yeah.
And that's, so most will do, and the technology is a little bit hard to switch.
And so if an attorney or their client feels that they think this particular motion warrants in-person argument, that it'll be better, more useful, what have you, effective.
Yeah.
Is there a way for them to ask for that to be in person rather than remote?
Yes, because we also don't have, also different from the Eighth, our motions are not heard. You know, most of it is by the majority is done on paper. But so when customarily, for instance, if it's a dispositive motion, I usually have hearings on those. If anyone requests the hearing, I almost always grant it.
Okay.
What I do if it's virtual is I send out a Zoom order to everyone. They know exactly what the link is. They know how to get on. Uh-huh. If they need space in the courthouse, they can come there. It accommodates a lot of attorneys from different jurisdictions who, and for instance, their client can be in one city and they can be in another city and we can. So that, I think that's that piece that we're a little bit different jurisdiction. We're tech savvy but not tech accomplished all the time in the sense of the judges. Our tech department is, but, and with JAVS. Of course. So that's a significant difference. But if somebody asks for a hearing, I think almost all the judges grant it.
What about for members of the public or someone from the press? How are they able to access a hearing if they want to?
So it's on our calendar. If you could pull on our calendar, it'll say what the hearing is, whether it's in person or by Zoom. And then they can actually click right on the case, and they access the Zoom.
Perfect. Thank you.
And in fact, the press likes it. Yeah. We often have people watching.
They don't have to leave their office.
Right.
Judge Jones, I had a question.
Yes.
If you're conducting a calendar, especially court or otherwise, by Zoom, where is the court staff?
Courthouse. Usually all of us are at the courthouse.
Are they all just individually at their own computers and in their office space?
Yes, cubicles? Because if we get too close, there's reverberation.
Okay.
And so occasionally I've had to have somebody sit by me in my, you know, either on the bench or in chambers. But usually they're in their court clerk office. Everyone is.
So whomever would be responsible, like a court recorder. They're not in the courtroom running that equipment. That would be somewhere else.
So in Ginger, we have court reporters, not court recordings. And so the court reporters appear from wherever their residence office.
So they're listening to the Zoom and just typing as they're listening to what's occurring on Zoom.
Just as if they were in the courtroom.
Okay.
And then on the family side is the JAVS recording. And so they don't have, they have to access it and it links into the Zoom, but they don't have a court reporter taking everything down.
Okay.
And then, so it's the, when we've had some challenges with the number of trials we've been having, the court reporters really like to be able to appear from where they live. We have several that drive in significant distance. And it, like anything, I think you addressed it in here in the protocols, is obviously there's moments of extreme patience with the communication and, you know, sure, stop moving around. But I think we're different people now than we were 5 years ago. And in a way, in many good ways and in many ways, that we share the concerns about decorum. And, you know, I never thought I'd have to be telling somebody you can't smoke in court or you can't wear your hat or, you know, we're just different. And I think that this is a wonderful, I think it was really had foresight to create this committee and to be working on this. Then as we move forward to these different times, we can address it. And so I definitely want to make sure that you know that our spirit was thank you to the committee, but here are some individual concerns. And after I go back and ask them if they took the survey, I'll say you may have missed out. So, any further questions? Thank you very much for giving me the time.
Thank you.
All right, are there any further comments on either of these 80 KTs, 581 or 613 in Las Vegas or in Carson City? All right, hearing none, seeing none. Unless there's anything further from my colleagues, these matters will stand.